Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. Before we get started, I'd like to ask a favor. If you haven't done so already, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you've already done that, thank you. These ratings help the show get discovered so it can reach a wider audience. And while you're there, click the subscribe button so that you get notified of new episodes as soon as they come out. If you don't use Apple Podcasts, you can visit driveonpodcast.com/subscribe to find other ways of subscribing, including our email list. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Today, my guests are Matt O'Connor and Brad Byers. Brad and Matt were shipmates together on the USS Stennis for a while during their time in the military. Matt was an active duty fighter pilot in the Navy until 2015 when he joined the reserves. And Brad was also a pilot in the Marine Corps until 2013 and later served as senior White House advisor to Secretary Mattis in 2017. Both Matt and Brad are working in the civilian sector now and are here to talk about their transition out of the military, as well as some of the interesting stories that they have from their time in the military. So welcome to the show, Matt and Brad. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your background? We can maybe start with Brad first, and then we can jump to Matt.
Thanks, Scott. I was really hoping that you'd start with Matt. happy to do it. Appreciate the intro. Had an awesome time in the Marine Corps, spending about 11 years flying F-18s off of aircraft carriers, meeting guys like Matt. I got to travel the world and deploy the weapon system as it's intended to be deployed, and met some great people, had some great times in port, and learned a whole bunch of leadership and management things. And after that, got a chance to enter the private sector with ATI and learning as we go.
Awesome. Matt, how about you? A little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Appreciate the opportunity to join you today. Grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. My grandfather was an aviator in the Navy, and from an early age, always wanted to fly. So I jumped across the Chesapeake Bay, went to the Naval Academy with one thing on my mind, and was fortunate enough to get a pilot seat. So went through flight school, fortunate enough to get Hornets, and then spent the rest of my active duty time, 11 years total, flying Hornets, crossing paths with Brad in the same air wing for a deployment on the Stennis, as you mentioned. And I really enjoyed that, echo his experiences of meeting great people and learning a ton. Followed him actually out, and we'll talk a little bit about that from a transition standpoint, in 2015 to join the company we both work for now, Allegheny Technologies. And there's a good story in that, but a lot of great experiences to kind of round out that everything we've learned in the military, plus how to apply that in the civilian sector, to really bring us to where we are now and what I would say are mildly successful transitions, from one life to the next. So looking forward to sharing that with you and your
nurse. So I've been told, so my father introduced, for the listeners, my father introduced me to these two gentlemen here. And I've been told that you have quite a few interesting stories from your time in the service. And I don't know, does that make me feel or sound like I'm an old man or something when I say it that way, like your time in the service? I feel like that's something my grandfather would say or something, but I don't know. Maybe it's just me being self-conscious, but.
Yeah, not at all. We had a wonderful night with your dad talking about sea stories over just a couple of beers, maybe a glass of wine or a two. We were in Huntsville, Alabama, and had spent some wonderful time with your dad, and very much appreciate his experience and wisdom and mentorship to us. So we do have some fun stories. A lot of them are funny. Some of them are more serious than others, but
most at our own expense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's one thing.
Well, those are the best stories.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about what we've learned. It's being able to look in the mirror and laugh at yourself every now and then, right?
Exactly.
Humility, I guess someone would call it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's one of the best kind of humor, when you can kind of turn it back in on yourself and laugh at yourself and not take things too seriously. You know, everybody's a goof sometimes, and they, you know, as long as you can let it roll off and, you know, laugh about it, it's all good.
Yeah, no doubt. Military will teach you that, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. So when you guys were stationed together on the Stennis, where was this deployment? Where were you located? Was this in the Middle East, or was this someplace else in the world?
Yeah, this deployment was 2009, and we did a WestPac. So we launched out of Southern California. We headed west, hit Hawaii, and then if you remember, in 2009, North Korea was kind of hot. Yes. Straits of Taiwan scenario was kind of hot. So we spent a lot of time in both of those scenarios. But one of the biggest missions, frankly, and one of the genesis of many of our stories is one of the missions was to flood foreign ports with capital, U.S. dollars. And we did that. We did that well.
Yeah,
one of the things that we are good at.
Showing the flag. Showing is the what flag. Some people would call it. Yeah.
So was that like the official mission, like going there and?
I think that was a tertiary mission. So I think the official mission was to be in and around.
Just be there. Be present.
Be there just in case.
Yeah. Exactly. We have a relative. Persistent presence in that part of the world. But, you know, that anytime you have a WestPac in, we'll call it non-war times, because we weren't necessarily at war with anyone in that theater. And the primary mission is, as Brad said, to show the flag and put capital into ports. You end up spending a lot of time in ports. So it was barely 6 months long, which is short by today's standards of deployments. And we were in port 8 times in those 6 months.
He's a tough cruise.
Tough cruise. Yeah. But, you know, for me, one of my most memorable times in a jet came out of that deployment. We were in the Sea of Japan in a thunderstorm. And, you know, not to get too technical about how to launch and recover airplanes, but they call aircraft carriers the world's biggest weather vanes, because ultimately you have to be pointed into the wind to launch and recover airplanes. And as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, a storm by nature has circular winds, meaning they're typically low pressure and they rotate counterclockwise. Well, if your ship and your home and your airport happens to drive into a storm, and there are aircraft airborne, it has to stay in that storm to recover them, because it's just trying to chase the wind around that storm. Well, that happened one day in the Sea of Japan, and I happened to be the tanker, so I was going to be the last person to recover. And during this recovery, the weather was so bad, the rain was so hard, we ended up diverting several aircraft to Japan. But there I was, a young lieutenant, relatively new to the squadron, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, as we used to say, just trying to get aboard, last guy down. And, you know, we record everything out of the front of our aircraft through our HUD, heads up display. And I kept the recording because I didn't see the ship until I stopped. And luckily I stopped, but it was, I don't know that I'll ever forget that. Like I said, it was my most memorable time in an airplane, but yeah, it was humbling. Yeah,
for sure. And, you know, like you said, luckily you did stop. And
luckily I stopped. And
didn't it was just keep going right by.
Out next to the ship. That's right.
But that is a testament to the not only the equipment on the airplane to allow you to land that way, but that's also right. the right. training that you received that allowed you to trust the equipment that well. Because I'm not so sure I would have trusted it. If I can't see it, I don't know that I'm going to trust it.
Right. Trust your instruments. That's key. And that plays into a lot of, you know, the transition and making that successful. You know, you have to trust the system and the process. And we'll talk about it later, I presume, but
yeah,
critical lesson. Yeah.
How about you, Brad? Any memorable events or stories from your time
Flying? Yeah. So,
flying, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't honestly remember a whole lot about that cruise in particular. You know, it was a fairly benign cruise, but I cruised in 2007 where we went to Iraq and Afghanistan and were supporting OEF and OIF. That there were several moments that, you know, will stay with me for forever, hopefully. One in particular was I joined the squadron relatively late in our deployment cycle. So all of the workups that were going on and I showed up about 2 weeks before we launched on our cruise. And so in transit, I'm trying to get all the qualifications required to fly into country. And I finally get to where the skipper and the carrier group commander are comfortable with me going in country. And my first night event, my first night combat sortie, was with my skipper, and it was over the eastern portion of Afghanistan, right at the Khyber Pass, if you remember.
Very familiar with that.
Yep. And
that's where I was stationed.
That right. Where were you? Do you remember the we called them kill boxes back then, but where you were?
I was right at the Turkum border crossing in Afghanistan. So it was right. Our base was about 2 miles away from the Pakistan border.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So this night we were flying an XCAS mission, which means we're just loitering overhead and being supportive, getting eyes on if and when there's suspicious activity. And we received a call that there was a troop in contact scenario, a tick, as you know, mm-hmm. And we expedited to the area, and we did at a relatively low fuel state. And as we started to get eyes on the target and situational awareness to what was happening on the ground, we got to our bingo fuel state, which is your signal to go get gas from an airborne tanker. And at the time, new guys, nuggets as we call them, were not allowed to yo-yo tank, which means you send one of the two aircraft that are flying in section to go hit the tanker while the other aircraft stays on station and supports the guys on the ground who desperately need it. But in this situation, they had already taken a KIA and they were under pressure. And so my skipper said, "Hey, Brad, I need you to go get gas." And I'm probably 27 years old, and I leave my lead, my skipper, and it's just a black night. And I think, holy cow. And the, you know, I'm trying to revert back to the brief and remember where the tanker is and all of the communications that I got to make and find the airborne tanker. So I rendezvous on a KC-135 over the middle of Afghanistan, 7,000 miles away from where I grew up, thinking, oh my gosh, where in the world am I right now? And what am I doing? I mean, I'm supporting guys who are under pressure. I got to get gas. I'm all by myself. All right. Plug in. I find the tanker by the grace of God. I get gas and I come off the tanker and I switch up a radio frequency where I try to connect with my skipper. And he says, "Hey, Brad, I just went Winchester," which means he unloaded all of his munitions and shot his gun until he was out of ammo. And he says, "They still need help. Do not drop anything until I get back from getting gas." And so I said, "Roger that, skipper." And I show up overhead. As soon as I check in with the JTAC or the FAC on the ground, the JTAC says, "Hey, I need a JDAM on this grid coordinate right now." And I start to explain, "Hey, I can't right now. I need to wait for my flight lead to get back, and then I'll be able to get that JDAM on that target right away." And he says, "If you can't, you need to get out of here. I need to bring in artillery." And I said, "All right, where is it?" Right. And he says, "All right, here's the grid coordinate." And he gives me a 4-digit grid, which, as you know, is not precise at all. It is a gross area.
It's a wide area, right?
Right. And so I said, "Hey, I can't do that. I need a 10-digit grid per our ROE. And he said, "Hey, you need 10-digit grid." He gave me a 4-digit grid. Let's just say 6420. And I said, no, 10 digit. And he goes, 64000200000. And I start looking around and okay, I understand where the friendlies are. I understand where he wants me to put this JDAM. And they're in an extreme scenario, they're under extremis. And I can hear it in his voice. And I said, all right. And so I start pressing out on a 10 mile run in, and my skipper checks in and he said, hey, Byers, what's going on? And I said, I'm on a 10 mile run to drop a JDAM. He said, give me the grid coordinates. And I give it to him in 10 digit grid, but with a lot of zeros. And he says, no way. And he checks in. Long story short, he confirms the position right before I need to get into my weapon engagement zone, my WES, and drop the weapon. I end up going Winchester that night. And by the grace of God, we allowed our brothers and sisters on the ground to break contact with the enemy and live another day.
Oh, that's great.
All but one of our brothers, I should say. And just something that gives me chills telling the story today. But it'll never leave me. You know, it's one of those stories that tattoos your soul.
Yeah,
for sure. And I'm sitting here as one of the guys who has been on the ground and had pilots flying overhead and, you know, dropping their bombs and everything like that. That's, you know, from the other side of the story, guys like you are very much appreciated by the guys on the ground because it makes it a whole lot easier.
Scott, had you known it was a guy like me, you would have run. I'll never forget, you know, I'm a knuckle dragger, man. I'm not the smartest guy in the room. O'Connor can't say that, but you know, you do everything that you're supposed to do. You're disciplined. You follow the process, and you press the button, and you feel the JDAM come off your wing, and your wing actually lifts up, right?
Okay.
And you go, and then it's just dead silence. You're not talking to the JTAC anymore. You're taking a cutaway. You're trying to get eyes on with your FLIR pod or your assets, if you will. And it's just dead silent. And all you can think of is, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, hit the target. And then literally like 27 seconds later, depending on your altitude, obviously, you'll get confirmation, you'll see an impact, and you'll get immediate feedback one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And there is no feeling in the world after excruciating, tense feelings for a JTAC to come up over the radio and go, good hits, good hits, good hits. I need another one.
Right.
And you're like, oh, thank God. Right.
Yeah. Thankfully you hit it. Right. And didn't hit somewhere else that wasn't supposed to be hit.
Yeah.
Even if it is within a 10 digit or a 4-digit grid.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, Brad, you also spent some time working at the White House. What was that like?
I did. So, you know, I got out of the Marine Corps in 2013 and came to work for the company that Matt and I are working for now, and spent, I don't know, 5 years or so with ATI, and then get a call out of the blue from a former colleague and said, hey, Brad, do you have anybody that has some DOD or military experience with private industry success? And I sent him about 8 resumes. Matt's was not one of them.
Thank you for that. Yeah. And best gift you ever gave me.
He called me back and he said, no, you idiot, send me your resume. And so I did. And long story short, I took the train down from Boston to New York City to interview in Trump Tower, and fascinating experience, as you might imagine. And the next thing I know, 2 days later, I get a phone call saying, hey, President-elect Trump would like you to be the senior White House advisor for Secretary Mattis. And wow. it was just, I had no business being there, frankly, and honestly, was humbled at the opportunity to go serve my country again, was torn a little bit because for a lot of reasons, but it was an extraordinary opportunity for me to give back to work with a legend in Secretary / General Mattis.
Right.
And
Mad Dog.
What a mentor and what a great human being he is.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
Pardon the interruption, but you know, I remember that time too, because you and I spoke a lot during that period.
Yeah,
because at the same time that this offer was on the table from the White House, you had just gotten a promotion with the company. So you were debating, well, what do I do? And what it came down to was the fact that, you know, when you interviewed, it was generically to be one of these special advisor positions. You didn't know what it was going to be for. And when it came to be Mattis, Department of Defense, you know, fellow Marine, you know, that kind of, in both of our minds, was the discriminator. Hey,
yeah,
we don't know what this means. We don't know if there's a future with ATI still, but you need to see what this means, because this is an opportunity that doesn't come along very often.
Yeah.
I was blessed to be a part of that decision, even because it's not easy to make a pivot like that.
That's definitely one of those, you know, once in a lifetime type of decision, or, you know, opportunities that come around. And, you know, if you don't take that, you probably years from now, you'd be kicking yourself thinking, you know, what if I did? How cool would that be? And, you know, all these things would have been going through your head. So I think you made the right decision there.
Yeah. And so, it was a fascinating ride, you know, 10, 11 months with Secretary Mattis. I spent just about every day with him and briefed him every morning, and was in the Oval Office with the president. I was at times sitting in Secretary Mattis's seat in the Roosevelt Room at cabinet meetings, representing Department of Defense on trade policy issues. And it was, to say it was surreal is an understatement, but it was a formidable experience. And there's some funny stories that maybe I'll save for private conversations over a beer someday if we meet.
All right, wonderful. Let's talk about the transition. I know that let's talk about your transition out of the military and how that looked like. I know a lot of guys and ladies who are getting out of the military, they struggle with that. They struggle because they lose that sense of belonging that they had, you know, in the military. They struggle dealing with civilians, struggle finding a job and all that kind of stuff. So what was your transitions like? Talk to Matt a little bit here and see what was your transition like, and how did that go? And you know, what did you find to be challenging, and how did you overcome some of those?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And, you know, maybe a little out of order since Brad transitioned first, and he's kind of pivotal in my story. But when I was transitioning, you know, I did what is made obvious that you're supposed to do, you know, all the online job boards, you know, jobs.com, Monster, Glassdoor, Ladder. And the challenge I had was I didn't really know what I wanted to do as a, you know, an officer in the Navy, a pilot. I knew I didn't want to fly for the airlines. So that removed one skill set altogether. But beyond that, my skill set was relatively generically leadership, right? An ability to take initiative, solve problems, lead people, which can apply anywhere. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, which became the challenge with those traditional portals. I didn't have effective search criteria to find, you know, opportunities that would be what I really wanted to do. So I got all kinds of random things like selling insurance and, you know, jobs that just didn't appeal to me. So I re-baselined my efforts and ultimately relied on networking and leveraged my LinkedIn account quite a bit. And out of the blue called Brad, who, though we flew together, you know, we hadn't spoken in probably 2 or 3 years at the time I reached out. He had gotten out 2 years prior almost. And it was one of those situations where I said, hey man, I'm getting out. I don't know how to do this. Can you help me? And he said, oh my God, I'm at a, you know, career conference right now. What do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. I'll do anything, energy, defense, contracting. And he said, oh my gosh, we do all that stuff. And I said, okay, when do you want me there? And, you know, long story short, you know, 6 months later, I was flying out to Oregon from the East Coast to join him in Oregon. He subsequently left 3 months later, different story.
Well, I'm aboard. I'm out.
See you later. But, you know, I don't know, a rotational leadership development program where I didn't have to know what I wanted to do. I would get an opportunity to try a bunch of different things. The point of the story is, and where I think my transition can be considered mildly successful, is that I was able to have that continuity point through Brad of that camaraderie that we get, you know, from the ready room of the squadron, where we would leverage each other. You know, a lot of times it would manifest itself in just using the old lingo and speaking the old speak just to feel comfortable. But, you know, having that relationship is kind of our brand within our company, where people know that Brad and Matt kind of get at each other and they provide levity in otherwise serious situations just from that, you know, that brotherhood that we built in the service. I think the hardest part of the transition has been 3 or 4 years later, trying to figure out, you know, identity. Now that we've been doing this for so long, you know, working through that emotion now, all these years later, still leveraging the fact that, you know, we did it together largely, I think, is the important piece. So, you know, when we talk about what made the transition successful, it was, you know, having someone that knew where we came from do it with us, you know, stride for stride. Mm-hmm. And we have many, many veterans within ATI. But I'm talking about someone who I knew in the service and actually had a relationship with prior.
It wasn't a good relationship.
It wasn't a good relationship. pardon me for the pun, but I had a wingman, right? And we can debate who's the lead and who's the wingman. And there's probably some $5 fines that conjures. But the point is, you know, I was able to leverage someone who had the same past as me to be successful in a new future, which is our transition to the civilian side. So that's my story. You know, it's a work in progress. You know, it's only 6 years now, which isn't a long time in retrospect, but that's my story.
Yeah. And I like that you were able to leverage your network and work with each other to help each other out and use that existing connection to find a way into the civilian sector. You know, Brad, you already dip your toes into those waters. How did you come across the company that you work for and get into that program?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, and I think Matt and I would both, I think I can safely speak for Matt to say we were very lucky in landing in a place where we had some sponsorship and mentorship at significant levels within the company that recognized our strengths that we came from the military with, while recognizing the gaps that we had in experience with respect to business and manufacturing in our case, and placed some confidence and trust in us that we could fill those gaps. But my story isn't entirely different from Matt. When I was getting out of the Marine Corps, I reached out to my network, although it wasn't active duty members that I served with. It was, you know, people that I had met over the course of my childhood, frankly, and time in service. And one of those people was a former Army infantry officer who had served in Vietnam, who I shot with when I would come home to Pittsburgh. I shoot a lot of trap and skeet, and he was a blue jeans and t-shirt beer drinking guy that I always hit it off with. And so when I was departing the Marine Corps, I contacted him and said, "Hey, I'm getting out and would love to come back to Western Pennsylvania." I didn't end up in Western Pennsylvania, but he introduced me to some great people within ATI, and one of which is one of our mentors, a guy named John Sims, who happened to be the president of one of our business units at the time, who served 13 years as a Navy surface warfare officer in the 80s. And he had obviously a great understanding and respect for the crucible that we had been through as young military officers. And at the time, he was excited and interested in establishing a program where he could bring mid-grade military officers from the military into private industry and rotate us around the business, get us exposure to operations and lean thinking, and sales and maintenance and engineering and other facets of the business, and see where, you know, what makes sense for us, and then deploy us into important roles within the business. And we were really lucky to do that and have sponsorship from a guy like John Sims and others, very important folks that really took us under their wing to teach us the things that we desperately needed to know. And I think for both Matt and I, it was great to be able to come in with some leadership and management experience, but not know anything and be comfortable in our own skin to say, hey, I know nothing about this. Tell me about your process. And hey, I'm a dum-dum, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Teach me why that does.
Right.
And there's some value in that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like, again, you know, leveraging that network and finding the opportunities that are out there. You know, I think a lot of times guys get out of the military and they kind of just go it alone, and they have that maybe tough guy attitude. Oh, I could figure this out. You know, I don't need help, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And, you know, why wouldn't you use a network if you have people available to you who can help you out? Why wouldn't you use that? So I think
that's, you know, we got lucky from personal relationships, but, you know, largely in any city or even outside of cities these days, there are so many opportunities for veterans to get connected.
Right.
I live in Charlotte, and there's an entity called Veterans Bridge Home that is a huge, they're not a formal veteran service organization, but they help, you know, veterans with transition and otherwise. And, you know, I'm affiliated with the Travis Mannion Foundation, which is more about, you know, honoring the heroes we've lost. But again, it's an opportunity where we can source connections for veterans. So, you know, Scott, I think one of the things you're getting at is what can we offer those that are approaching transition or in transition?
Yes.
Ask for help, reach out. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of us, and most of us have done this, right? There's no one that should feel like they have to do it alone. And it's easy, right? It's easy to fall into that.
It is.
Feeling, not knowing how to do it. Or, you know, I had to kind of rack my brain and fail first before I realized, hey, I have this whole network of people that I can leverage. Why am I not doing that, right?
Right. Well, and
Go ahead.
Yeah. So a while back, I had interviewed some people from the VFW, American Legion, other organizations like that. And I think people who are in the post 9/11 era kind of see those organizations as kind of like the old man drinking club kind of thing, like that's where their grandfathers belonged and, you know, things like that. But if you think about it, organizations like that exist. And yes, sure, there are some you know, Korea, Vietnam, you know, older veterans who are members of those organizations, but they all those people at one point or another went through those transitions, and they have their own networks. So it only makes sense. Like, if you have nobody else, like no friends on the outside that you can reach out to, like you two did, join an organization like that. You know, go meet up with some of these people, and they have connections. Some of them are, you know, business owners, or they work for, you know, corporations and things like that. Go out and make these connections, and see if you can get that kind of assistance, or, you know, that maybe they'll offer you some advice even on where to go to, you know, get the help that you need as far as, you know, job search and things like that, you know?
That's a great point, Scott. And as you do, if I could offer one small piece of advice that I think was important to me because I was lucky and stumbled onto it, but in retrospect, looking in the rearview mirror, it was critical to my success or moderate success. I think it is pick the mentor, not the job. Go find a mentor that you want to work with, that you want to have teach you and coach you. Because I think that's the most critical thing as we transition out of the military. Okay. You know, we have so many great skills. We can offer so much value, but you need a mentor to guide you through the lexicon and jargon and the language differences. It's not a ready room. It's not a platoon. Right. It's different. It's great, but it's different. And you just need a little bit of guidance and help through to navigate the way.
Yeah. Corporate America and the military definitely have two different languages. The acronyms are not the same, and the languages don't necessarily mesh. So, you definitely need, it's almost like you need a boot camp of, learning how to be in corporate America, somehow.
It's funny you say boot camp, and Brad talks about mentor, because that, from day one, no matter your commissioning source, your drill instructor, your detailer, those are all mentors in a way. I mean, they're right. teaching you, and sometimes it feels very one way and it's not comfortable, but they become mentors and that, that comfort blanket. And then you can transition that into your, your organizational structure and your commanding officers and otherwise, those are all mentors. So in the military, you're used to always having someone to look to, someone to learn from, someone to leverage. If you're lucky, someone that's looking out for you, frankly, that's different. And they're not easy to find, as you transition. But to Brad's point, find one. And work for them. Don't just get a job for the sake of getting a job, right? You're selling yourself short there. So,
when you guys say find a mentor and find the right mentor for you, it's not like you just Google who's my mentor, or find mentor.com and just grab somebody, or just bump into somebody on the street and it's like, hey, you're gonna be my mentor today, and go about your day. How did you go about finding the mentors that you guys had?
That's a great question. I'll jump in if you don't mind. To me, it was really important for me to ask a lot of questions, show some industrial humility, to say, hey, listen, I don't understand what this income statement is saying. Hey, our quarterly results just came in. Who can I talk to teach me about why inventory is a good thing on a statement when it's, it's a bad guy, right? And tell me about why it's a bad guy. Tell me why that's a liability. It's actually an asset on a financial statement, right? But it's a liability in reality. And how do you begin to understand that stuff? The only way you do that is by raising your hand and saying, hey, I don't understand this. Can you show me? And when you do, and when you come forward with honest questions and an interest to learn, people will fall over themselves to teach you.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's absolutely right. But prior to that point, if we're talking to someone who is trying to figure out how to do what we just said and get a job for the mentor, not for the job itself. Brad was kind of talking from the standpoint of what do you do once you're in a job to secure a mentor? Treat an interview as if you're interviewing the company, not as the company interviewing you, right?
Right.
Come prepared with the questions to ask to find yourself a mentor.
That's an important
point. Know yourself and know how you think you need to be developed. Know what you want to get out of a relationship and make sure that hiring manager or company or entity can give that to you. So, to answer your discrete question, Scott, that's how you find the mentor. You interview the company. It's not the other way around. And I think that's where a lot of people, they figure they just need to show up and say the right words and answer the right questions and get interviewed, right? No, you're interviewing companies. You want to work for the right company. You want to work for a mentor. And you need to look at it that way. You need to be patient, right?
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think that's where a lot of people fail in their job search, is that they're looking for a job, any job sometimes. And they get all nervous at the interview, and you know, are they going to want me? Or, but if they flip that script in their head and say, am I going to want them? You know, not to walk in there cocky and arrogant.
No,
you know,
no.
Not like that, but you want to make sure that that's a company that you want to actually work for.
There is no reason a veteran anywhere should feel desperate. Right.
What a dichotomy that you just articulated and highlighted, right? This dichotomy between, hey, I'm valuable and I have a skill set that is desirable. And oh, by the way, as we look around the corporate landscape, God, we want more of us around.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But you balance that with intellectual interests and some industrial humility, and you ask good probing questions, and you look in the mirror and say, how can I get better? And hey, I'm really interested in personal and professional development. How does this company and organization and culture facilitate that? And hey, I'm really interested to learn more about finance because I don't know anything about it. Tell me how I can learn more about it. It is an honest, open kimono, as we might say, that may be politically incorrect, I guess, but you know, hey, these are the strengths that I bring and the warts that I have and the gaps that I have and how I think I can get from where I am to where I want to go. And how can this organization help me? I think, gosh, if I interview a candidate that said something like that, that says, hey, these are the strengths I bring, here are the gaps that I have, I want to go from here to there, man, I would eat it up.
Well, and it's all on the table at that point. You know what is in their head, what they're thinking. They know what you have to offer as a hiring company, for that particular job. And it's very transparent. Everyone knows where each other is sitting there. There's no surprises.
Yeah.
I think it's a win-win. You don't want to walk in on day one and then throw a curveball, at the person who just, you know, put their neck out there to sign off on hiring you for a job, and then all of a sudden say, well, this is what I'm really looking for, and now that I'm here, gotcha, kind of thing.
Yeah. And as hiring managers, we're not looking for perfection.
Right.
We're looking for good raw material.
Willingness. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're able to be trained on a job, and I think anyone in the military can definitely be trained on quite a few different jobs. I mean, they had to be trained to do their job in the military. So why can't you be trained to do a civilian job as well? Obviously in the civilian sector, you don't want to necessarily spend all your money on training and things like that, all your time and resources on training, but for the right candidate, for the right person for the job, I think it could definitely be worth it. So, you know, just because you don't necessarily have the training from the military, I don't think it necessarily means that you're unqualified for a particular job in the civilian world.
That's a great point, Scott.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, any other closing thoughts that either you, Matt, or Brad have before we wrap this up?
No, Scott, I appreciate the opportunity. You know, we did enjoy getting to know your dad and getting to learn from him. We gave you a little bit of tipper ahead of time, but, you know, trying to leverage all he did with Danaher into our company. And lastly, I just want to, you know, respect your brother, Stephen, I believe, right?
Yes. Yep. Thank
and,
you.
You know, thank him for his service. Thank you for your service and your loss. I think never forget, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely appreciate that.
Happy to be a part of this. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'd echo all that. Tough to follow. And one of the things that your dad told us that resonates with us, that I think this is all about is respect for people, right? Build trust, build relationships, demonstrate respect, and you'll be successful. And thanks for all that you're doing, Scott, and that your family has done.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both very much. It has been a pleasure getting to know you and chat with you today. Thank you very much again for taking the time to join me.
Thanks, Scott.
Absolutely.
Good to be with you, man.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com, or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.